For information about investing in character-led companies, please visit www.rocinvestments.com and join the growing number of investors choosing to make character a priority when investing their money.
Welcome to another episode of Return on Character Podcast with me, your host, Dan Cooper, founder and CEO of Rock Investments, an investment strategy that allocates capital on the basis of the character witnessed amongst the CEO and senior team of public companies. Today, I'm honored to have a guest that has chosen a career path that most of us wouldn't because it's so darn difficult. And it takes a lot of courage to be in this arena. James Koppel has long distinguished career in youth work, education, substance abuse, and crime and violence prevention. A nationally recognized speaker and writer in this field, Mr. Koppel has served as the founding president of Community Anti-Drug Coalition of America, vice president and chief operating officer of National Crime Prevention Council in Washington, D.C., president of the International Institute for Alcohol Awareness, and most recently, senior policy analyst for the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, and is the founding partner of Strategic Applications International. Now, that's a lot to take in, and I'm hoping, James, you would explain all those titles in that in your story and how you got started in this field. Because, like I said, you know, you have chosen to focus on an area that most of us would look at and say we don't know how to help in those environments, in those arenas.
Well, Dan, first of all, thanks for having me. I look forward to this conversation, and I have to say that most of those three titles are a result of being very old. So I've run a long race. But I most recently, and it kind of helps to explain going backwards, I'm head up an initiative right now called Act Now, which is a program of Rockefeller philanthropy with funding from Walmart, from Stand Together, from Skoll Foundation, from Joyce Foundation, and a bipartisan effort to deal with police reform. And it was created after the murder of George Floyd almost 3 years ago now. And we're working in 16 communities, talking to people that normally don't get invited to the table on police reform. But my doctoral work is in medieval church history, which has little or nothing. Yeah, it has nothing to do with what I do now, except that it helps me work with Congress, as I sometimes tell people. And that if ever you need a Latin phrase translated, I'm your guy. But I started off in an academic career and went through a very difficult time or transition. I wound up teaching public school in Western Kansas. And then in Central Kansas, I was assistant superintendent of schools. And my superintendent walked into my office and he said, "We have 23 separate funding streams coming into the school district dealing with substance use and violence, particularly gang violence." And he looked at me and he said, "Fix it." And he turned around and walked out of my office. And I wound up forming a coalition of organizations, community groups, but most significantly for my daughter said to me one night at the dinner table, she said, "Dad, I saw your press conference today and your strategic plan for dealing with gang violence in the community. Have you ever met a gang member?" And I laughed and said, "Well, no, but I know I'm against what they're doing." But it prompted me to call the chief of police the next day. We helped fund part of their gang unit. And I said, "I want to ride with the gang unit." And so I met at the police department. They put me in a bulletproof vest, told me what officer to follow or not follow. But on that first night, we rolled up on a drive-by shooting, and the officer I was to follow got out of the car. I followed him, and I knelt down beside a 15-year-old who had been shot, and he was bleeding out, and I held him as he died in my hands. And it changed my life forever. The mother was leaning over his body, yelling, "Help me, help me," and there was nothing I could do. So for the next 18 months, four nights a week, I rode with our gang unit doing street interventions and gathering data and information, interviewed over 650 gang kids. A house was shot up in a drive-by shooting because of a gang piece that we had brokered. And
Your house was?
Yes, my house.
Did you say your house was shot up?
My house was shot up.
Wow.
And I started really writing about it and did a lot of work with the police department and also the community. Started a coalition called Project Freedom. About that time, the President's Drug Advisory Council, when President George H.W. Bush was president at the end of his term, was launching a national organization. I came back. I was asked to come back and apply for the position. I got the position, and I started Community Anti-Drug Coalitions of America, known as CADCA. And for the next 5 years, we wrote major legislation. I traveled the country really wanting to learn what communities are dealing with youth substance use and violence. Wrote the Drug Free Communities Act, did a number of policy pieces, then went to Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, then went to National Crime Prevention Council, which was McGruff, Take a Bite Out of Crime, and I was the chief operating officer for that initiative. And then I met my wife, she had also been involved in gang prevention activity and work in Salt Lake City. And we got married and we started our own company, Strategic Applications International, and our nonprofit, which is called Servant Forge. We're very faith-driven, and we have worked internationally. Colleen is LDS, and I came out of the Church of the Nazarene. I was actually ordained as a minister in the Church of the Nazarene. And we started working in East Africa. We had several contracts working with USAID in Swaziland, now Eswatini, and then also in Kenya, and on gender-based violence and police reform there as well. I facilitated President Obama's task force on 21st century policing 8 years ago. And just last week, we finished that same task force reconvened after the murder of Tyree Nichols in Memphis. By five officers who beat him to death. And we reconvened that task force, and we just issued our second updated report on a whole of society, whole of community approach to criminal justice and police reform. And so I spent most of my career working in that space and then also working on gender-based violence and human trafficking in Africa, and now working again on human trafficking here in the U.S. So, but throughout that journey,
well, I just wanted to say thanks. You know, I've worked in some of these in challenging environments, and I know what it takes. Sometimes it takes a toll, and the challenges, the emotional challenges of working in those environments is tough. And I've worked in Washington too, and I also know what that's like. So, good job for, you know, passing legislation. you know, given the context of where we are at today and police reform obviously is a big topic. George Floyd incident is seared on the national conscious. Could you speak to us a little bit about your thoughts on police reform, how to go about it, the core of some of the challenges that you see, and you know, what are we missing? What is it being told to us that should be told to us that should be considered in solving this problem from your perspective?
Well, interesting enough, historically, we've created the police we want. When we needed slave patrols, we had slave patrols. When we needed enforcement of Jim Crow laws, and we asked police to enforce Jim Crow laws. When we launched a war on drugs, we asked the police to be the enforcer of the war on drugs. And oftentimes that enforcement has come really through a segregated environment. The police we get in wealthy or suburban communities is protect and serve. The police we get in many of our inner city environment is sort of shock and awe. It's a kind of a conquest mode, an adversarial relationship. And what's happened, I think, over the years, policing has become paramilitary in its approach, and it's in our expectations. And we're discovering that that approach, and even the people that we've recruited into policing, do not look at the community as a partner. And interesting, 8 years ago when we did President Obama's task force and we gave him the report, most of our recommendations focus on what police needed to do. And the report we released last week to the White House Domestic Policy Council focused on a whole of government and a whole of community approach. Community has to be at the table to really express the policing they want and need. In some communities, policing is that we're over-policed. In other communities, we're under-policed. But the culture of policing, because it was pointed out after Tyre Nichols in Memphis, you had a black man who was beat up by five black officers. And so as the chairman of the city or the head of the city council in Memphis pointed out, this is not a black problem. It's not a white problem. It's a culture problem. And it has to deal with the culture of policing. And so what we're focusing on now is looking at how we recruit officers, how we train them, really, truly building community policing where the community is at the table. We're looking at alternative and holistic approaches. Not every police call should be responded to by police. Some cases, it's a mental health expert. Some cases, it's a substance use expert. It will vary. But this is going to be a long struggle to really change that. There are 18,000 law enforcement agencies and over 800,000 law enforcement officers. And most of them, 99% of them do it right. But there's that 1% that will get attention. But it also goes to expectations and also leadership. I mean, it's a command and control structure, paramilitary in focus, where local law enforcement, and the biggest complaint of local law enforcement is that they're not given the permission to really make their own decisions or their own choices. And oftentimes they're situational. You know, on average, a line officer is given 700 different tasks they have to master in order to do their job. And there's very little flexibility, and everything becomes then a violation of policy. And so giving law enforcement more creativity and opportunity. So it's a, you know, since Ferguson, Missouri, where President Obama launched his task force out of that experience, there have been over 133 task forces, working groups, councils that have tried to address police reform, but we're still shooting people of color. And so it's going to require this cultural shift, and we need mayors, county execs, we need them involved in the discussions on police reform, not just the police, in order to really achieve good outcomes.
One of the questions that I, you know, given the topic of our podcast, character, you know, when we analyze leadership, we look for four characteristics. These four characteristics happen to be correlated to actual performance in Harvard-based studies and things like that. But the four characteristics are integrity, responsibility, forgiveness, and compassion. Those four characteristics, the research has shown to be universally defined as character in other cultures and all over the world. Do you think character in any way has a role to play? I believe it does. I'm sure you do. But how could it play a role in the reforms that you're talking about? Have you ever seen an example of character really making a difference in the arenas and or the neighborhoods, you've worked in the communities that you've tried to help?
Absolutely. It's essential. I think of Jermaine Harris, who's a lieutenant in the Chicago Police Department and works in community policing. He is a value-based, faith-based individual, but not just Christianity. I mean, he looks at the value system across the in some of the most violent neighborhoods he works in. And he set up sports programs. You know, I raid with the Chicago Police Department and a program that Jermaine was working on related to getting police officers to be coaches. In one of the most violent districts of Chicago, I got out of the squad car with a cop fully dressed in body armor and everything else, doing his regular job. And a bunch of kids ran up to him and they said, "Coach." They didn't call him cop or police. They called him coach because of his involvement in the community and his commitment. And so being transparent, telling the truth. Yeah. In an experience I had related to the Task Force on 21st Century Policing, when we gave the report to the president, I was giving a rundown on the recommendations. And I wasn't really scheduled to be in the room because I was just the facilitator. But then I was asked to be in the room because I had written most of the report. And I'm all of a sudden in the midst of this, I said, this report reflects my view of mercy and justice. And I started going through the recommendations. And the president stopped me and he said, go back and tell me what you mean by mercy and justice. And had this amazing conversation about values and about what I was important to me. I'm a social justice advocate. You know, I am all about equality and freedom of access and giving power to the powerless and giving voice to those who have no voice. And that is directly tied to the faith values I am embraced at the age of 15 and started living those faith values. Everything from doing a mission project with my church that was only supposed to be 3 months, but I wound up spending a year and a half in Bolivia because we were setting up mobile clinics. And I helped organize these mobile clinics at the age of 19. And it all was tied to these values and to the character that was sort of inherited in part from my John Wayne type father, who was a World War II vet and decorated, but he, you know, you stood up for those who didn't have a voice and you advocated for those. But at the same time, I realized John Kennedy in my generation was a huge influence, and the way he integrated his value system of faith to his advocacy for certain policies. And I actually paid my way through college in Boston doing John Kennedy speeches in high schools. And so integrating all that history into what I was to eventually become and what I'm doing now was transformative. I mean, if I could just relate this other one story, I'm in Nairobi, Kenya, working on our gender-based violence project, and we're going to put in 5 water wells on the border between Sudan and South Sudan. And I'm flying on the only way you could get into this village was either fly or go in by boat. And I'm flying in, I had to negotiate with the government of South Sudan in order to get us into the region and then also to put the water wells in. And I remember flying in that plane, and I was with a very good friend who was visiting, and I just looked at him and I said, you know, I'm doing exactly what I felt I was called to do. Government relations with missions, to be able to tell the story of who I am and what I am and where I came from, and to always speak the truth and to always bring who you are to the table and not compromise that. I turned down a $10 million grant because I refused to do something that a foundation wanted me to do that I felt would lead to corruption. And I just, if part of the DNA, if you will, legacy that I've inherited. So
one of the things that's unique about you is that you've been literally hands in the dirt, right? And in Washington, where policy is being made, and you understand the pathway, I'm assuming, between the two. I mean, naturally, lots of us have skepticism that legislation can really change a community or even the culture of, say, a police force, for example, or the character of leadership. Are we right to be skeptical? Have you seen examples of it working where legislation really did shift things in the right direction and you saw it on the ground kind of like working?
Yeah. Well, policy is only as good as its enforcement. You can write all the policy you want and write all the legislation you want, but other communities own it, embrace it. It doesn't happen. Everything from what might be considered in this conversation a little bit trivial, but you know, we adopt policy that you got to wear a seatbelt. And unless it's enforced and people wear seatbelts, it's not a good policy. And the same thing in this space where I've worked. It's interesting. When we wrote the Drug-Free Communities Act, Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House. And I had to meet with him as we were navigating through both the authorization and appropriation process. And he looked at me and said, Dr. Koppel, I understand you have a degree in history. And I said, I do. And he said, and I knew he did too. His degree is in modern European history. And he said, well, I'm going to ask you the Napoleonic question. How many members do you have in congressional districts? And he says, it's the Napoleonic question, which was Napoleon was going to invade Italy, and his advisors advised him not to invade the Vatican. And he goes, why? How many legions does the Pope have? And as if the Pope could stop him. And so Gingrich asked me, how many legions does the Pope have? And I said, I have about 100 members in every congressional district. The day the legislation passed in the House, it passed 420-1. Gingrich called my office, and my assistant said, Jim, Speaker Gingrich is on the phone. I'm like, yeah, right. She goes, no, seriously, he's on the phone. And I got on the phone, and I said, yes, sir. And he goes, Jim, your legislation passed 420-1. My question to you is, what are you going to do to the one? And I said, I'm not going to do anything. You know, it turned out to be Ron Paul from Texas, who was a pro-legalization guy on drugs. But what we've seen in the development of community coalitions across the country around prevention is the consistent, persistent messaging, also increasing the capacity of treatment. Every dollar we spend on treatment and prevention, we save $8 on incarceration. And so the more we can
do... Break that down. Yeah. Treatment and prevention. What do you mean by that? What kind of treatment? What kind of prevention?
It can be all kinds of treatment. It can be increasing the number of treatment beds. You know, it's interesting. Substance abuse treatment is usually focused on 28-day programs, which... It had nothing to do with the science of treatment. It had to do with the availability of 28 speakers in Minnesota. But it became the pattern around which insurance companies support treatment. But you get somebody into treatment, or using the other end of that in terms of occupying a bed and getting intensive counseling, also using medications to help detox them, etc. But you can go to the other extreme of that, through a program called ESPERT, which is screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment, which is if a medical doctor asked one of his patients, what's your relationship to alcohol? That in itself is an intervention. And you get somebody talking about it. And if they begin talking about it and the doctor has the skill set and knowledge to refer them to treatment, then that individual has a chance of sobering up. And the interesting thing in this country around policy, on average, 10 years ago, the average medical school only spent 1 hour on substance abuse addiction. Now they're spending on average 10 hours. And so they're raising awareness in the medical community. Those kinds of policies, and again, if they're adopted, they're trained and they're enforced, and medical doctors become aware of the relationship of addiction to other health issues, then you're going to see an improvement. Now, as Lloyd Johnson at the University of Michigan points out, in addiction, particularly substance use, you have this generational forgetting. And that what was messaged to me as a young person is a different message than my children. And because my children receive messages differently, and you have to consistently and persistently convey the message. You can't just assume you're going to stop addiction. You have to constantly be messaging on it. And so the policies that we develop that reinforce that and build capacity in local communities is critically important.
Is that a kind of prevention? Would you define it as a prevention from a law enforcement perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. If a law enforcement officer even pulling on a traffic stop, for whatever reason he may have done the traffic stop, and he realizes that the driver may be intoxicated, his approach to that can be punitive. It's the same thing we're dealing with human trafficking, Dan, is that in San Diego, a model program where when I first met with officers in San Diego, they referred to women being trafficked as whores, prostitutes, bitches, you name it. It was all a negative framework. Once they got created proximity and started talking with these women and understood the complexity of the issues, they started referring to them as survivors and became advocates for them. It was a complete transformation in the way law enforcement dealt with that population, most of whom had been trafficked. That's the same way with addiction, is if I approach somebody that may be, again, in a traffic stop or a domestic violence, I mean, 80% of the domestic violence cases in this country, there's alcohol involved or some kind of substance involved. And when a police officer goes into a domestic violence situation and they have certain skill sets or places to refer people for treatment or interventions, or you're bringing somebody alongside you to assist in that intervention, it changes the whole dynamic. It's not automatic. You're going to throw the handcuffs on them, throw them against the wall, and take them into jail. It's going to be taking them to get treatment.
And from a perspective of funding state, local cities and areas, it seems like, at least I'll speak from my perspective, is the prevention side seems grossly underfunded as opposed to the reactionary side that is having to deal with a lot of the difficulties. Is that a mind shift that you think is realistic for really governments to start adjusting funding so that there's more of an orientation towards prevention versus just reaction?
It's a perennial chronic problem in policy discussions, is that historically we only spend about 20% of our budgets on these issues on prevention. The rest is on enforcement or treatment. And so that's why we over-incarcerate. You know, we have 2.3 million people in our prisons and jails, large measure because of addiction. And we don't do the prevention programs. Oklahoma City has got this great program called a diversion hub. It's actually a deflection program. A police officer will pick up a young person on the streets, and if there's no wants or warrants for that young person, they will take them to the diversion hub, not to the police station. They don't book them. They don't create a record. And the diversion hub has all kinds of resources and organizations at the hub. They're called justice navigators. And they get the young person into a program that can help them or strengthen their resiliency. And when you do that, you're saving money in terms of what you would spend on treatment or incarceration. And you're keeping a young person out of the system, because once you're in the system, you are in the system. And it just turns into this recycling. A good example in Oklahoma City, I interviewed 10 women and 10 men who are about to be released from prison. And every one of them had, on average, a fine or a fee that they had to pay up to, on average, of $20,000 before they could get a driver's license to go to work. You know, and so it just recycled them back into the system. They were never going to win. And so a lot of communities are ending fines and fees as a way which to add on to a punishment, but to give resources to reintegrate the individual back into the community. And so when we're spending money on prevention, but it's always a hard sale, because as a country, we like the quick fix. And our quick fix, we don't want to see it. We don't want to see the addict on the street. We don't want to see the heroin addict. We don't want to see the prostitute. We don't want to see these people. We want them out of the way, so we warehouse them in our prison system, which just recycles them back. And it's a horrible investment in terms of what we're doing. We're spending so much money, on average $70,000 a year, to keep somebody incarcerated, that if we invested in getting an education or using a navigator to keep them, get them access to resources that would help break the cycle of addiction, we'd be much wiser, and it'd be better for them, and it'd be cheaper for us as a community.
Well, one of the things that I know that is a challenge on the government side is that they're incentivized to justify spending and keep spending by the way in which, you know, they receive grants and programs and things like that. They're not incentivized in any way to reduce certain budgetary line items in the future for the benefit of getting more budgetary line items over in another area. It takes almost some creative legislative human, proper human motivation structures to get, I would think, people thinking about saving money at the local and state level as opposed to prevention capital allocation versus just spending and responding. Have you seen any examples of that working where people, the governments have been able to figure out, how do I actually motivate the police force to want to do this versus just say, they feel like you're pulling my funding for some other program that may or may not work?
My experience in working with cops is they're all about results. They want to see results and positive outcomes. And most of the police we've talked to, and we've interviewed over 1,500 line officers, sergeant or below, in the last 2 years, and out speaking outside of the context of their unions. And they all see the importance of investment in keeping kids in school, keeping kids off the streets, creating programs. Yep. There's research, which for years I've talked about. There are five things we can do with young people. One is a young person who has hope. You can use the word faith, something that pulls them into the future, that gives them a reason to get up in the morning. The second thing is if they have significant adults in their lives, it could be a coach, a teacher, a grandparent, somebody that cares about them, right? Mentors. A third is acquired skills, something they can celebrate. It could be music. It could be athletics. It could be whatever it is, some skill development that they can celebrate. The fourth is a locus of control. That is, they have a voice in shaping their future. They're at the table discussing their decisions and their choices. And the last is altruism. They're given an opportunity to give something back and contribute. You give those five resiliencies to kids, they're less likely to be involved in substance abuse, crime, teenage pregnancy. All the numbers go down in the lives of a kid where you have those five resiliencies. And that's based upon a government-funded longitudinal study of 20 years of youth behavior. And if we can do those five things. But I have very little confidence in the federal government to solve our problems. What I do have confidence in is the power of local communities. But the local communities have to speak up. They have to set their priorities, you know, and instead of marginalizing, because what we've done historically in this country is that we have created ghettos of communities that are underemployed or unemployed, who have lack of education, who do not have access to the same kinds of resources. And you've got the 1% of the population that continue to get rich. And there's no sense of economic justice. And I'm not a communist or a socialist, but at the same time, I really believe communities and neighborhoods and city governments and county governments can do more to make it a level playing field. And we do that by increasing youth access to education, building programs around those resiliencies. Because you know, go ahead.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I did want to say, is there any examples that you can share with us of stories that you did see communities come together and work like this?
Well, in one of the most conservative states in the country, Oklahoma City is doing some amazing things around really building out community capacity and listening communities. They're doing these listening sessions. They're doing these things called breaking bread events. And in the breaking bread events, they're bringing white and black communities together where they're talking through solutions, coming up with recommendations. They've repealed and remodeled their jail system as a result of these breaking bread events. They've eliminated fines and fees. They are setting up these diversion hubs for kids to keep them out of the criminal justice system. I look at areas in West Chicago where, a mother in one of the most gang-involved neighborhoods this young mother invited gang members into her house on a Friday night for dinner. Those kids set up a safety plan for their district, and they had no violent crime in 7 months. You know, and that's, it's just neighborhoods and communities coming together and giving them the power. And the grant-making process should be to incentivize that kind of innovation. For a long time, the federal government wanted, you can only do things that are evidence-based. You got to prove that it works. Well, it completely shut down innovation. And we live in an accelerated environment. Things are constantly changed, and it requires innovation. And the innovation doesn't come out of Washington. That's the last place it usually comes out of. Innovation comes out of local communities, seeing a problem. You know, one of the things when I was in Wichita, I got a call from a principal saying, Jim, I have a family whose son is in a gang and they want to get out of a gang. Now, you had to be jumped out of a gang, which is a violent exercise if you want to leave a gang. They beat you up and you can get killed. And they said, we want to relocate. They want to relocate from Wichita to Hutchinson, Kansas, about 35 miles away. And so I called a church in that neighborhood and said, we want to move this family. It's got to be confidential. I called the gang unit. The police staked out the neighborhood while we loaded them up in a van and moved them to Hutchinson, Kansas. The Wichita Eagle newspaper called me. They heard the police traffic, and they said to me, what are you doing, Jim? And I said, well, we're kind of creating this underground railroad where we're helping kids get out of gangs and helping to relocate. We relocated over the next year and a half, 300 families across the country using churches as the host networks and to help the families relocate, get the kids in school, get them jobs, etc. But the faith community became the network of this underground railroad. It's always Time Magazine did a piece on this comparing what we were doing on gang prevention and intervention with about four other communities. And the tagline, as somebody who has to raise money, this tagline was to die for. Time Magazine says, well, at least Project Freedom is saving lives. And that with that kind of interview, but we were given the encouragement to innovate. And we designed this program. The churches wound up in the community, wound up committing. They took what was called a fifth Sunday offering. So every month there was a fifth Sunday. They took an offering, especially for the Underground Railroad. And we relocated all these families. Pastors got involved, parishioners got involved. But we need innovation, and we need to encourage innovation and incentivize it, not tie it to the tyranny of some previous practice. I'm sorry, I'm preaching.
That's an amazing story. Thank you for sharing that. You know, one question I do want to ask you about, since you've been in, because of your experience. This notion of grace, second chances, forgiveness of past wrongs. You know, there's one side of a called America that says there needs to be absolute justice all the time. I know of a program, for example, in Dallas, I believe, where they give the highest offended members of the community, people that have caused most problems in the community, a home to live and to address the problem. Some people say, well, they shouldn't get a home for being so bad. Others people say, well, we should try to be addressing these few elements that are causing such big despair. In your experience, do you see, you know, the balance between grace and justice in our society as it relates to crime and addiction and these communities that we're all trying to fight to preserve?
I hope this is acceptable for your show, but I wrote a piece some time ago called A Theology of Shit. And in the Theology of Shit, for God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten son into the shit. And brokenness in humanity and a lot of pain and suffering. And that we are called, in my faith tradition, to live out that shit, to live out that work in that brokenness. I've never met a child that I want to give up on. Now, there are violent offenders people who, for any number of reasons, need to be incarcerated and segregated from the community. But if I see the slightest wicker of hope, I'm gonna try to design something to build on that foundation of hope. And so if it's housing that an offender needs, that's going to break the cycle, then let's work toward that. If it is monitoring and evaluation of their status as they go through their parole life, then I want to find what that is. If it's getting them into a substance use program or treatment program,
sure.
Or a woman who has been trafficked and has gone into crime as a result of being trafficked, if housing, small group support. I mean, I was at a gala last night of a human traffic program where they have served over 5,000 initiatives, 5,000 women across the country who were sexually abused as children, and which led to all kinds of bad behavior. But because of those interventions, there are communities that would just to see some of the people even who have been sexually abused who then turn to some form of crime or violence in order to survive, or addiction. They want them, again, warehoused and segregated from the community. If I see the slightest wicker of hope, I'm going to try to find grace and mercy, because I think that's the grace and mercy I've received throughout my journey in a variety of contexts. And but it's the value system. And I share that with my Muslim brothers and sisters and my Jewish brothers and sisters. The golden rule is consistent in all three of those major traditions, is that it may get behaved and operationalized differently, but if we can share that common ground, then we're going to go on this journey together.
Well, I think I could talk to you for a couple hours, 3 or 4 hours, but I'm not going to abuse your kind time more than we have. But I do want to just end this with an opportunity for you to share what you're doing today and how people can either get involved in what you're doing, learn from what you've done, and maybe even hire services if there's a town or city out there that's desperate for some help. I can think of no other person better than for you to coach, to be coached by. So James, just tell us a little bit more about how people could reach out to you.
Well, probably the best way is our website, sai-dc.com. And, also our Act Now project is actnow4.us. And, those two websites give a pathway for people to serve in our nonprofit Servant Forge, which is about building leaders who, in all professions, who seek to become servant leaders. But that's probably the best way, and it kind of summarizes our various projects we're working on right now. Our space is law enforcement reform and also human trafficking.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, and most of all, thank you for your long obedience in one direction of trying to make a difference in some of the darkest spots in our nation and in the world. It takes great endurance for those of you that don't work in these environments. It takes great endurance, and it takes a lot of faith too. So again, James, just thank you for your time and thank you for who you are.
Thank you, Dan. It's good to talk with you.